My message for you this morning is that this gathering, this first parish of Sudbury, is a congregation that is totally unique, just like all the others. Naturally, no two churches are ever quite the same, any more than any two snowflakes are 100% identical. But when it comes to frostiness and whiteness and star-shaped symmetry, there are some family resemblances among snowflakes, and indeed there are also recurring patterns that churches exhibit, regardless of their differing histories or personalities or locations or denominational affiliations. Many of these similarities have to do with size. There's been a whole lot that's been written about mega churches that draw thousands of people on Sunday morning with rock bands and charismatic preachers. While there's been much written about that, the demographic fact is that most congregations in these United States, the typical congregation, is a much more like this one, with something just under 100 people sitting down in one room to worship together. Numerically speaking, there may be actual more bodies going to those mega churches, to the crystal cathedrals, but most actual sanctuaries do not look like football stadiums or TV studios or cineplexes. They look much more like this place where we're gathered, because the folks in these smaller gatherings aren't going to church for the halftime show or the TV ministry. They're coming because in places like this, they can almost surely see a familiar face. They can have some assurance of having a genuine human interaction. They can have the experience, which is hard to find these days, of both knowing others and being known. Churches on this smaller scale are sometimes called pastoral-sized congregations, and they are defined as having between 50 and 150 bodies present on Sunday morning. This upper limit is very important. It's so important that Malcolm Gladwell, the author and social scientist, calls 150 a magic number, because there's a whole lot of evidence that Homo sapiens, our species, evolved to live in tribes of just about this size. One British anthropologist, for instance, did a worldwide survey of hunting-gathering societies, all those primitive cultures for which we have some information, from the Walbiri of Australia to the Ona people of Tierra del Fuego. Of course, these differing cultures are also like snowflakes. Now, two of them are the same. They've got different customs and mythologies and languages, but they do have some things in common. They're all very small. In that survey, the typical village for these hunting-gathering people was 148 people, seldom more, which just coincidentally happens to be the average size of a modern Unitarian Universalist congregation. The reason for this seems to be that 150 is about the number of people that most of us can comfortably keep track of without starting to get confused about names and faces. Among primates, we have the biggest neocortex, which gives us a larger social capacity than most of our animal kin. So baboons, for instance, live in troops of about 50 individuals. Chimpanzees with a larger brain may have 80 family members in their extended groups. People have the largest social networks, but even we have limits to what our cerebrums can handle. When you get beyond that magic number of 150, then organizations become more anonymous and more complex. You start needing policies and procedures and rules and protocols to help the group function and stay on task. Congregations at this larger level are sometimes called program-sized churches, and often they have multiple paid staff and layers of reporting and decision-making. But a congregation like this one, a pastoral-sized congregation, is simpler and less formal. It might find its counterpart in the business world in a firm like Gore-Tex, which is a very big outfit. I'm sure you know it makes rainwear and dental floss and specialty fabrics. But it deliberately operates with a small company philosophy, so that whenever a Gore-Tex manufacturing plant anywhere in the world reaches the number of 150 employees, they automatically do not expand that existing plant. Instead, they build another plant somewhere else. And at that new plant, they put 150 spaces in the parking lot. And when those 150 spaces are full, they know that it's time to expand once again. This is a billion-dollar corporation, but by dividing and redividing, they manage to have the feel of an entrepreneurial startup in keeping with this small is beautiful ethos. There are no organizational charts at Gore-Tex. There are no bosses. There are no secretaries. There are no job titles. Everyone who works in a Gore-Tex plant is called an associate. And because everybody in this small group knows everybody else, it just works out that peer pressure and peer support is usually enough to keep productivity and innovation high. And this is also how small churches operate. Word of mouth and the power of personality and reputation are usually more important than the bylaws if you want to understand how things get done. Now, I personally have served pastoral-sized churches. My first congregation out in Washington State on the West Coast had about 150 members. Sometimes our reports went up a few members, sometimes they went down a few members, but it was fairly consistent, and about half of that number could be expected to show up on a given Sunday morning, maybe 70, 80 people in the congregation, which made it a scale very similar to what you have here at First Parish. And it was similar in this way, too. This was the warmest, kindest, most nurturing collection of people that you could want to find anywhere. I loved it there. Ministers go ecstatic about this kind of congregation because they are so relational. A pastoral-sized congregation congregations usually function in a way that make the clergy central to the emotional system, so that as a minister in one of these churches, you can actually have some degree of intimacy, be personally acquainted with every member of your flock, which is really the reason many people go into ministry, not to look at budgets or spreadsheets, but to bond with other people. And a group like this functions a little like a single cell or a single organism. It has its own homeostasis or internal equilibrium. So although we tried to make that little church in Washington grow and become something bigger, for some reason the organization just had its own ideas. 150 was its zone. So from one perspective you could say we were stuck there, and from another perspective you could say we were stable. But in retrospect, I think that maybe instead of spending so much time trying to turn that church into something else, we should have spent more time appreciating what we had and savoring who we were. And First Parish of Sudbury might learn from this experience, I think, because one of the things that makes this congregation different from other UU churches in this area is your relatively small, manageable size. Like yours, those other churches in Stowe and Wayland and Framingham and Sherburn and Concord, they're all old and historic. They also meet in aging, white, clabbered meeting houses and are mostly filled with aging white people. Like yours, those are welcoming congregations that embrace folks of differing sexual orientations. And like First Parish of Sudbury, they practice principles of tolerance and religious freedom. But unlike this community, those tend to be larger and mid-sized churches with bigger budgets and slicker websites, and often with labyrinths and handbell choirs and medical clinics and food pantries. And this has sometimes resulted in steeple envy. With folks here occasionally feeling a little less than those larger churches, which can be a feeling that is exacerbated by a Boston, which is always beating the drum for quantitative increase. But you do have something qualitatively different and special and valuable to offer here, which is a degree of connection and camaraderie and mutual care, which is very hard to find in those larger churches, which really does flourish best in tribe-like settings. Human beings have evolved. We are designed. We are wired naturally, our nervous systems, to function optimally in village-like settings, just like the First Parish of Sudbury. And that's one reason why I'm not too worried about the church growth experts who say that the future belongs to the megachurches, that the small congregations are destined for the dustbin, because you can't change a million years of biology overnight. Despite talk of a global economy and the advent of social media, the human animal remains a clannish creature, local in his sympathies, loyal to her immediate in-group. And I think this is the real danger that faces small congregations like this one, because the same traits that make smaller churches such friendly, supportive places can also tend to make them parochial and ingrown. One example might be the sharing of joys and sorrows, which has become a familiar and beloved ritual in many UU churches. Lay people, by the way, tend to love this unrehearsed, free, spontaneous sharing of personal concerns. Ministers are not so crazy about it on the whole. There's a great deal of trust involved in this kind of sharing, as we heard this morning. Friends with cancer, parent figures nearing the end of life, traumas that strike us at the core. There's a great deal of solidarity in a congregation that can hold these sorrows in care, where people feel safe enough to share such things. And yet that sense of solidarity and safety can also feel somewhat overwhelming and even off-putting to the newcomer, the guest, the visitor. This extended sharing of personal, sometimes heavy information on Sunday morning can feel like going to someone else's family reunion. And I don't think that is by and large true here in Sudbury, where the milestones are usually fairly short and discreet, but it's an illustration, I think, of how the same customs that feel inclusive to some may be experienced as exclusive by others. So congregations like this one need to be especially mindful of reaching out to strangers, precisely because there are so few strangers here. You need to realize that it is not easy to be a guest in a church like this one. If nobody notices you or talks to you over at the First Parish of Concord with 800 members, that's a one thing. You don't really expect that you're going to get much attention in that kind of crowd if nobody notices you or talks to you at the coffee hour here at First Parish in Sudbury. Well, that's rough, you know. So you have to work harder here to make sure that this is a religious community that actually practices hospitality, that serves the larger world, that's not just a club serving its own members. Because as people of faith, you do have a mission to extend love and acceptance to all of the displaced, rootless, often lonely and hurting people who could find a life-giving home in liberal religion if only they knew that Unitarianism existed and if they had half an invitation to join. And why would people want to join this particular congregation? Well, there are points where First Parish truly shines. 2 weeks ago, your choir did a foray requiem that could compare with the best choral music anywhere in Boston. Truly an outstanding performance for a congregation of this size. And last month, you created in this sanctuary a carnival with musicians, with lion tamers, with clowns, with stilt walkers, with acrobats doing handstands down the center aisle, a cast that included 40 or 50 people of all ages, children and adults. The First Parish of Sudbury does not excel at everything. No organization does. But you do have a phenomenal aptitude for the arts in this congregation. You have Morris dancers and quilting groups. You have coffee houses and magic shows and May Day festivals and holiday revels that celebrate the sheer exuberance of living. This First Parish is where creative people congregate, and rather than hiding that light under a bushel, you need to make it a limelight. And of course, one of the facts about a spotlight is that it doesn't illuminate everything. By concentrating on the main attraction, other things that are on stage naturally fade into the background. So in choosing to specialize, you necessarily have to set priorities, which means that some activities here may become more peripheral. So related to the question of what makes this congregation unique and different is the question, what are the programs and events here that are more marginal to your identity? What are some of the things that you may be doing that are depleting time and energy that could be better used elsewhere? And I cannot answer that question for you. But I will observe that after all the hard work and the many long hours of producing that carnival under the big top, Lori Parkhill made the comment that when I'm doing this, I don't feel 70 years old anymore. And I think that would be a good measure to apply to all of your activities here at First Parish. Does what you're doing make you feel old and weary and tired and dreary? Or are you engaging in work that, despite the fact that it's hard, despite the fact that it's challenging and difficult, makes you come alive, that feels purposeful, that rejuvenates your spirit and invigorates your soul? The Unitarian E.E. Cummings, whose poem I'm a Little Church provided the opening words, also offered the advice, damn everything but the circus. Damn everything that's grim, dull, motionless, unrisking, inward-turning. Damn everything that won't get into the circle, that won't enjoy, that won't throw its heart into the tension, surprise, fear, and delight of the circus, the round world, the full existence. So to sum up, celebrate yourself, because this congregation is not like other churches. You have something special here, but also celebrate yourself. Kick up your heels. Let loose. Sing hallelujah. Let your being radiate the flamboyance of who you are, so that even if you are one snowflake in a blizzard of snowflakes, you can still get in touch with your inner flake.